And already 10 people apologized to me that they wouldn't be able to attend the talk. So those were my supposed friends.
It's a selection event.
It is. I think you're here longer. So Bob sent me an email and said, do you have anything new you want to talk about? And just that day, I happened to start a project with a postdoc at LBL on the extreme supernova and their environments. So I boldly suggested this would be my topic. And so I want to go through this, and I think this will cement some of what I have found to be the most important ideas here floating around the conference. Not that I have any answers, but I think it will highlight some of them. So you've seen this, light curves, narrow, faint, broad, bright, and the spectral series, which just says that it's a more or less a temperature effect. And what you have in the extremes here are usually the presence of Fe3. By the way, Fe3 is usually in these spectra, it's just dominated by Fe2. David Branch was pointing this out to me a while ago, and this point we rarely state, but there's almost as much Fe3 in these normal guys as there is up here. It's just here all the Fe2 is gone, so you see the Fe3. And down here, you get the titanium that creeps in. And you have, you know, a nice match with this idea. And the whole thing here is that you make more nickel, okay? And so here they are in their gory detail. And so these are what I'm going to define as the extremes. I did not like, and I will apologize to Wei Dong, I do not like the idea of the subcategory 99AA. But then again, it is its own separate class. It's not a normal. The difference between 99AA and 91T is in general the presence of the calcium H and K line. It's stronger in here. These guys are just a little bit cooler, but they do show the strong Fe3 lines, and there's very little Fe2. The 91BGs, this is it. It's Ti2, it comes in. And this is how I'm going to go about and classify things. So I'll lump these two guys together, and I'll have this one. But there are differences between these two, and I will point those out. So following the basic idea, this is sort of the back of the envelope. Dave Arnett gave me a few hundred lines of Fortran to do these calculations. If you put in about a tenth of a solar mass of nickel, given injection, velocity, kinetic energy, about 12,000 kilometers a second, you're going to get something like 91BG. Rises in about 12 days or so, order of magnitude fainter than your regular 1As. And the 91Ts, likewise, you go in, give it about a solar mass of nickel, and they rise in about 23, 24 days. And normal guys sit in between, much closer to these guys. These guys... I'll go in and explain. Dan has some more detailed models. There was a very interesting plot by Tom Matheson that I'll comment on in just a little bit about why the number density of the objects in this range right here. So where does a supernova get its velocity from? This is a little side thing that I want to point out with the subluminous ones. So as Andy showed, there's three sources of energy. You got a sink, the binding energy, the nuclear energy is where you get your boom, and the difference between the two gives you your kinetic energy. And so some interesting back of the envelope results for this. If you want a kinetic energy greater than zero, you have to have something, a nuclear energy that's greater than the binding energy. For a Chandra mass white dwarf, that's about 0.5 Fo. So what this says is we need about 0.3 solar masses of nickel, or a combination of nickel and intermediate mass material, to get an explosion. And so for the subluminous supernova, the 91BGs, it has an absolute magnitude. Peter Garnovich wrote Cepheid distance to 99BY, a clone almost of 91BG. We know their absolute magnitudes. These two factors, its light curve shape, its peak brightness, tell us it made about 0.07 solar masses of nickel. So how much of the rest of the star was burned? Just to have it reach a positive velocity, you have to get an additional 0.4 Fo from the silicon group. This means that 0.3 solar masses of IME material was made, and that just gets you to a velocity of zero. To get you to the velocities that we see in 91 BG, which are only about 20% less than your typical supernova, it's likely that around a solar mass was burned to IME. So this is telling you, and Dan's plot here shows this, that if you look at the band here where supernova exist, and the characterization of the models that Stan and Dan did here was basically, we have a amount of nickel, we have a amount of intermediate mass material, and we have some unburned material, and that's it. That controlled more or less what you're seeing and why there's differences here. These guys burned almost completely. And it's interesting to note that over the entire span here, you, in order to fit this, you're very close to the edge of always burning the entire star up. Maybe not 100%, but very close to that. So that's something to keep in the back of your head. The other thing here is the number density. This takes you from 0.2 solar masses of nickel down to 0.1. 0.2 makes you're around 86 G, maybe a little bit brighter, and then you fall off a cliff here once you go down. And the reason is those titanium lines come in and they kill the B-band flux. So number density of supernova in this area is going to be low because very fine steps in changing the nickel mass cause the flux in the B to drop radically. So it was interesting to see that those numbers are increasing, but just from what I think, if there was a smooth distribution, it's unlikely that those numbers will ever get very high compared to the other ones. And so that's that region. So, biases. Okay, so now I'm going to insult everybody but myself. No, I'll insult myself too. All searches are biased, one way or the other. Okay, this is absolutely fine so long as you know what those biases are. And people here, we've heard several talks about how they go very carefully back and try to figure out what these are. So pointed searches, catalog-based searches, this is like Kate, like what the amateurs do. The problems, they don't get the low luminosity host. Okay? Advantages for Kate is that compared to the typical peak brightness of a supernova, they go much, much deeper, okay, than anybody else. So they find them very early and they find very faint supernova. So that's a huge, huge advantage for learning about supernova in my mind. The pointless searches, the supernova factory. The problem here is that faint supernova on bright hosts are not detected or followed up. Okay? We put in a percent, you're surveying 3,000 square degrees of sky to 20th magnitude. You got to have some cuts or you're going to be studying dwarf nova all the time. No. So you get AGN, you get variable stars along the line of sight to other galaxies, you get a whole bunch of things. Okay? We have to put in a cut. One of our cuts is we demand a certain percent increase in the supernova in order to go after it. The other thing is we also need a certain percent increase in order to get good spectroscopy of it. If it's buried in the host, that becomes a problem too. Advantages, we sample the low luminosity host quite well. Matter of fact, we are complete, I would say, on the low luminosity hosts. This is very similar, though not exact, to the high redshift searches. So biases in the searches at HiZ, the past searches, the SCP, the HiZ supernova search team, we were pushing the envelope here. We were detecting things at the edge of our detection limits. We never bothered with objects. We had percent increase cuts. We never bothered with objects that were faint on big hosts. You'd never get the spectrum of it, you know. And they weren't rolling. So you couldn't go back after the fact and say, well, gee, this one had a 1A like light curve, you know, but we didn't ever get a spectrum of it. Let's go get the host redshift now, you know. So there are problems with that, very similar to what the SN factory has. Present searches, and I include in here SDSS. This is a high redshift search in my mind. Beyond a redshift of 0.1 is high redshift, because I can't do spectropolarimetry of it. So spectroscopically tend not to get the low percent increase targets. If you have time to do a 24th magnitude object that has no host and looks like a 1A, and a 24th magnitude object on a 22nd magnitude host, you only have 10 hours of Keck time, you know what you're going to be doing. Okay? Now, it is a rolling search, and they have colors in these things, so they can go back after the fact and photometrically type them. And I think this should be done. It's one of my assignments at the end of the talk here, is that this type of thing needs to be done. You need to go back and get the redshifts of every single host galaxy, of every single transient, so that we can go back and classify them via the color and know what's going on. And I would say the HST searches, the one we just heard about from Adam, the good searches, they use color information. This can be both good and bad. Cluster search that the SCP is doing, well, that's a pointed search. They're coarsely rolling. They don't quite get the same color coverage that the other searches do. So it's a little bit harder to go back after the fact, but it's not impossible. And here are just some examples. Typically in a ground-based search, you would not take a spectrum of this guy. It's buried in the host. Now, I signed on with Richard Ellis, Lord of the Dark, and he said, we will try to do these. And so if you got that much Keck time, you can actually go through and do it. Ground-based ones, guys like this are easy. Guys right on the center, very hard. This is very typical of low-luminosity hosts that we go after at high redshift. Here's a note on the color. Adam had a graph there of 98S that's very UV bright because it had an interaction. Here's a more typical type 2P at day 10 at a redshift of 1. And here's 91T. You'll notice has no calcium really here. It's very blue. And here's our average template in the SNLS. So while color may only get you the 1As, you got to be careful. You have to make sure you're not biasing yourself one way or the other by adding in too many non-type 1As because their colors are the same as 1As, or to make sure that something crazy doesn't happen with the 1As at high redshift with extinction. So I think when you have a 1-ish, 2-ish sigma result, we've got to be very careful. Now, the result's very interesting, and I like it. I like the direction it goes personally. And I'll get that in that here at the end of the talk. So host galaxy studies at high redshift, Mark Sullivan has done a very nice job. And the first one was with the SCP data and doing ACS morphology studies and Keck spectroscopy studies of the hosts. And, it was a very nice job. Scatter in the Hubble line was less than the ellipticals, not surprising, perhaps just due to extinction. And the fact that they were about 0.1 magnitudes brighter than their spiral counterparts sort of backs this up. But that was the starting work. He didn't really have the ability to push it farther until the SNLS. And this, I think, is one of the key results here that we've seen this past week, is that the stretch, the brightness of the supernova, if you will, changes. From the strongly star-forming galaxies, it's much higher. And to the passive dead galaxies, it's lower. It's clear signature that the environment is affecting the mechanism of the 1A or the progenitor system, one or the other. So these are the 91Ts. They see some of those. There are the 91VGs. To date, I do not know of a high redshift search that has found a 91VG. They are very, very hard to do. It's not to say that they're not necessarily there, but it's just you're not going to go after an absolute magnitude 25th galaxy huge elliptical with a little dinky supernova on it. You just won't take the spectrum of it. So 91VGs and 91Ts, where do we stand? Well, the first sort of classification paper on the numbers of these did way long time ago with David Branch and Adam Fisher. We had about three 91VG likes and one 91T. A few years later, Weidong upped that rate a little bit because the Kate search had started to kick in really well. But as of last night in the IAU circulars, we have about 50 of each. All right, really surprising number. Two things to note. NGC 2841 has two confirmed 91VG-like supernova and two other SN1s. Okay, don't know what they are. NGC 1275 has a 91VG-like and another SN1 whose light curve is not too dissimilar from a 91VG. So it's interesting that these galaxies have not necessarily produced other types of supernova, but have definitely produced an abundance of 91VGs in the past century. All 91T-like objects that I have either seen spectroscopically or have heard from the IAE circular that there was no calcium and I can trust it's a 91T-like, and not in 99AA, they mention the presence of extinction almost all the time. Almost every single one has a large amount of extinction, an EB minus V of 0.3, magnitude of extinction in the V band. They also mention a conspicuous sodium D line at the redshift of the host. So these guys are associated with dusty regions. Now, I'm sure there are some 91Ts out there that have no extinction. I just haven't seen them yet. It would be very nice to look at that. So, going through all the numbers, this is what you wind up with if you look at the K-band absolute magnitude. Now, these are based, I cut the sample back, and I did it only on the pointed searches, the amateurs and the cape-like searches. I excluded the pointless blind ones. So what you notice immediately is that the 91BGs, of course, are in the biggest, brightest galaxies. The 91T-likes and 99AA-likes, they occur all the way down here. They're not found in these guys. Now, if you think about the RC3 catalog, which is where most people get their galaxy list to go through and do the search, it's incredibly biased by over an order of magnitude towards the bright big galaxies, the ellipticals and the S0s. So the fact that you have seen so many 91Ts in low luminosity galaxies tells you that their rate is incredibly high, and that these guys, compared to these guys. So that's one thing, and you're clearly seeing that the star formation rate is affecting the SFR, as Chris Pritchett and Mark and others have pointed out here. If you look at the B minus K colors, they clearly separate themselves out into two distinct groups, and there's very little region where they overlap. There are much better ways to do this. I think B minus K is an okay look at star formation, but there you can do models and get UV colors and do a much better job than this. So simply, time is a factor, I think, if you look at this. Nickel production, early on, low luminosity galaxies, you know, you're getting almost a solar mass of nickel out of these things. And as time goes on, it drops down to 0.1. This to me seems to be, you know, it's a very simple view, but there's something there that's going on. And this is clear now as we get more and more data. This is showing up in greater and greater numbers. Here's an interesting plot that Andy showed in his Super Chandra talk, but I think it also says something about the supernova. Here I plotted the silicon 2 velocity and the luminosity in ergs per second. Black are early type hosts, red are late type hosts, and the circle size is proportional to dV/dt of the silicon line. So it's proportional how quickly the photosphere is receding or not. And what you notice here is that the old and young populations show a different relationship between what I've characterized as a kinetic energy and, say, the nickel. And what's interesting is that at the same luminosity, you can get different branches. So perhaps this is suggesting two different paths to making a 1A. It keeps on hitting me that there's some sort of conspiracy going on. So if there's more than one progenitor system, say something like the A plus B model we've heard so much about in the past few talks, then you must explain the relative populations of the subluminous, overluminous, and the normal ones, and their evolution accordingly. And I think you may be able to do it, but that's an interesting conspiracy that would be going on. If there is one basic progenitor system, then how does the age tie itself directly to the amount of nickel that you make? Okay, maybe there are ways of doing it. Ken Nomoto suggested something a few days ago, and I think that's a possibility. So here's the homework for the theorists and the observers. Come up with a mechanism that nicely ties the age to nickel 56. Perhaps, as Ken suggested, with the angular momentum differences in the old and young populations. Question I have is how low, how high can you go? Could you make a 1A with 0.01 solar masses of nickel? Is that possible? Should we do searches for absolute magnitude minus 13 objects?
Yes.
You know? Okay. Well, I think it's a very interesting. This is more a personal question. And the other question for the explosion model is, why does it always seem that you burn the rest of the star no matter what? Is it a selection bias because we'll never see them otherwise? These to me are very interesting questions that these extreme guys bring out. Rule in or rule out progenitor systems based on the rates and whether or not they would likely be able to follow the age luminosity effect. I think we're almost getting to the point where we can do that. If you come up with, say your single degenerate system, then you have to explain how that will change the nickel mass. Observers, work hard to determine the rates of the subtypes of supernovas. And it's not just good enough to do this is the rate of 1As. I want to know what the rate of the subluminous ones are. I want to know the rate of the overluminous ones, because I think that could show us the path to whether or not there are two different systems. Photometrically ID everything in the rolling searches and get their host redshifts. This would be a great way to go back and do it. We have wonderful spectral templates for all of these classes of supernova. You can go back in and determine what they are after the fact, even though it may be too difficult to get their supernova spectrum. Work hard to determine the rates at Z greater than 1. And as Adam showed, there's very nice, very intriguing point there, and I like it because I read the paper by Kobayashi and the metallicity effect and how you need just a certain amount of metals before you can kick in the 1A production. And to me, that was a nice sort of idea, and I like it. And when you see the rate dropping down there, it sort of leads you in that direction. But then again, it's sort of a 1-2 sigma result, and that's a very powerful statement, so it'd be very nice to know what that is to high precision. And that's where I'll end.
Thanks, Peter. You should stay. You shouldn't go to do your homework right now.
Well, as long as you're assigning homework and asking people to look at data, you know, more carefully, one of the things that has to be the case is that some of the systems that have failed to become type 1A progenitors must be doing interesting things that show up as odd light curves. And it would be interesting to know from the observational perspective, especially for people who are looking at more nearby galaxies, are there oddball light curves that have been popping up but that may not have, you know, attracted a lot of attention the first time around because they're clearly not 1As? I mean, these non-progenitors are the necessary complement of progenitors, and they can they serve as calibration points.
Yeah, and they can certainly lead us in the direction of what the progenitor systems are likely to be. I know that there are a few groups that are starting to use wide field imaging on nearby clusters, and they want to start to get nightly coverage, hourly coverage during the night, minute coverage during the night, and hit these fields for 2 months on end to try to search for these things. But that's down the road a couple of years from now, but it'll be very nice.
Well, some of the data that exists may have it already.
Yeah, it's tough. Wide field data is tough.
Yeah, Roseanne, I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying. With the Kate thing, we and Bob's group and others do try very, very hard to get a spectrum of every single object that we find. And I think, you know, we don't non-announce to our friends objects that we don't think are supernovae. Like, you know, they might be far from the host galaxy. We may express our reservations, but we still tell our friends, try to get a spectrum. And I know Bob's group has worked very hard, and I know mine works very hard to try to get those spectra. So we are not ignoring them just because we don't think they're a supernova. Okay. Well, as I said in response to Lars a few days ago, I mean, we have not found anything, for example, that clearly looks like a 0.1A supernova. But we have not clearly ruled them out either. It's just we get a spectrum of nearly everything that we find, and so far all we've found are things that looks like supernovae, you know, or a few cataclysmic variables or whatever, you know.
It would be very nice to get a good a photometric model for some of these very low luminosity events so that we could characterize a search in which you could hope to find one. And also an estimate of what you think the rates would be based on the model, because then we'd know the number of density galaxies we'd have to go after to get them. But it's a tough search. Finding supernova nearby is much more difficult than finding them at high redshift, as Rollin will tell.
Thank you.
Yes. Much more difficult.
Yeah, just to complement that, Alex, you might have said that M85 ended up with this peculiar type of nova. So you do find stuff.
Yeah, that's right. And we didn't hide that from people. We announced it. We announce everything and hope that people will follow them. Absolutely. Our cadence is such that, yeah, we won't catch the things that rise and fall in one night or two nights even sometimes, you know. But that's what you get. We can't, if we followed three galaxies all the time, then we wouldn't find many supernovae. So it's, you need a compromise.
Yeah, another thing that I can contribute from my experience, I've followed a lot of that stuff, is that we in this conference we always think about the things that can be like that, but there's lots of other stuff that looks exactly like that, like flare stars and AGNs, and those contaminate these things, these searches. So you can say, well, I want to go after the things that change during one night, but you will find many of those, and most of them will not be point 1A's or anything interesting.
No, just one other comment. If we have in our template images a clear stellar object there, and we see a variation, we don't usually get a spectrum of that because there's just a ton of variable stars out there, as Bohdan Pachinski likes to tell us, right? So, but if there's no object at the position where we detect something for at least two nights, we will attempt, or Bob or others will attempt to get a spectrum of it.
Okay.
Peter, very interesting. You looked at both extremes. What does the plot of the host luminosity look like for all those tons of objects that are in between extremes? Is it?
I have not done that because, because it's a lot of IE circulars to go through.
Yeah.
Searching.
Well, it'd be nice to have confidence that. The luminous ones, the 91 T-like objects, are statistically different than the ones. There's a lot of objects in there.
So if we did in the SNLS work, I know we've done a cut on the host luminosity, and when you sort of pull it down, I've seen Mark do something. He dropped down a few magnitudes and just showed me what the stretch distribution of those guys were, and they were all on the high end. Although some of them had. I mean, we do know of supernovae that are very broad light curves that are bright that do not look like 91
right.
T's. They're the 99AW, right, and 01AY, which is twice as wide as a normal supernova,
right.
But looks normal. So those are other things that we have to worry about as well.
Right. Just quick question about 91 TD. Is it just bright nickel is over, or abundance distribution is different, the iron is over silicon layer or something?
I have not seen any models done where if you just take a normal 1A and give it more nickel, you can't reproduce most everything that you see in 91T. So that's my guess. Now, could there be? Yeah, but I don't think people have pushed the detailed spectroscopic and photometric calculations that far yet.